Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and this discussing episode where we are going to discuss something which in a sense I feel actually slightly underqualified to discuss. Normally I'd like to bring in a guest and try to have a very one-on-one discussion about something that we've already done quite a lot of work on, but our exploring sessions actually haven't quite caught up with the playwright who is our primary focus for this this discussion episode, John Fletcher, who is often associated with lots of other playwrights because he liked collaborating rather a lot, as you will hear. And though I have read and seen a percentage of his work, we're not sort of immersed in John Fletcher. So this is actually this rambling introduction is very much an opportunity for you listening that this will be as much an introduction to you as to me. And going forward, we will be reading more John Fletcher in our exploring sessions on YouTube. So if you like what you hear over the next however long this episode turns out to be, then you can join us as we discover how true and accurate our guest's thoughts are, because our guest has written two tomes out to date that we are explicitly going to be talking about in this episode. So I will ask my guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hi, Robert. Thank you for having me. My name is Domenico Lovascio. I am an associate professor at the University of Genoa in Italy. I teach English literature. I teach first year undergraduate students, and I also supervise a number of PhD students. On the research side, I'm interested in several aspects of early modern English drama, theater history, textual editing, the plays in the canon of John Fletcher and his collaborators, Anglo-Italian relationship, the reception of classical material in early modern drama, and lost plays. Two of my most recent pieces of work are two books on John Fletcher. One is titled John Fletcher's Rome, Questioning the Classics, and the other is a critical edition of The False One, which appeared in the Revels play series. They both were published last year, 2022.
Yes, and they are available, and be talking about those in some detail as we go forward. So let's start with the basics. Who is John Fletcher? Who was John Fletcher? As it happens, the date we're recording this on, this is coming out very soon after we're recording this this discussing, so it's almost on top of the listener as well as us. But this date is actually the 29th of August. Is significant to the life, as it were, of John Fletcher.
Yes, because it is the day on which he was buried in what is now Southwark Cathedral. So John Fletcher was born in 1579 into a strongly Protestant family in Rye, in Sussex. He was the son of the minister Richard Fletcher, who then became Dean of Peterborough. He attended the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, and later became Bishop of London, so it was a pretty big deal. However, Bishop Fletcher died in 1596 in disfavor and debt, as he had lost the support of Queen Elizabeth because he had remarried after his wife had died, and Queen Elizabeth did not really like that aspect of the bishop's life. John Fletcher attended the grammar school of the Cathedral Church in Peterborough when his father was Dean of Peterborough, and this institution was very strict. So John and the other boys in the grammar school were required to be at school every working day at 6 a.m., both in winter and summer. They would start the day by saying some godly prayers, then they would read texts in Latin, translate them, memorize them on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. On Fridays, the boys, the pupils, were expected to repeat to the teacher all their Latins by heart that they had made that week, and to parse all that Latin to analyze the text, and at afternoon to repeat all the lectures taken that week until 4 o'clock. Finally, on Saturday morning, scholars would be assigned a lecture both to labor and to expound without the book the following Monday morning. So the weekend was not free. So there was a very strong focus on repetition and rote learning, which must have been overwhelming. There was very little time for fun in this school, and the scholars were to be given leave to play according to the statute of the school, but once in a whole week. As this was a cathedral church school, supplementary significance was placed on attendance at religious services, so much so that it seems that the boys had to attend the cathedral at 5 a.m. before prayers in school at 6.
And it really does go to show that, you know, I'm looking back at my education. You know, I'd like to think that I'm a reasonably well-educated chap, but you look at a grammar school education, God, they worked people to the ground. They really did.
Absolutely. Yes. And I'm insisting on this because this is relevant to Fletcher. I think it's relevant to Fletcher's outlook on classical material. As for university, probably Fletcher went to Cambridge, but it isn't clear whether he attended Corpus Christi or Queen's College. But anyway, it is likely that he did attend university. Nothing is known about Fletcher's life between graduation and his first involvement in writing a play, which is The Woman Hater, which he wrote with Francis Beaumont. In total, Fletcher had a hand in around 50 plays. His first plays were mostly written for the children of the Queen's revels, but when the King's Men started using the Blackfriars Theatre, they seemed to have acquired the service of the Beaumont and Fletcher duo. It isn't clear how Fletcher and Beaumont met, but they may have met through Fletcher's patrons, who were the Earl and Countess of Huntingdon, because Beaumont and the Earl, Harry Hastings, were cousins. A letter survives from Fletcher to the Countess, Elizabeth. This letter shows the closeness of Fletcher's relationship with this aristocratic family, and it suggests that Fletcher shared both his patrons' aversion for courtly extravagance, courtly spending, courtly lavishness, and the desire to see James finally renounce his pacifism.
Sorry, I just want to pick up on a few points there, because we're entering into the realm of Jacobean politics, which is very different to Elizabethan politics, and this is something we're very much in the middle of in terms of our as we're exploring early Jacobean plays as well. You know, there's this great hope that James is going to do certain things, and then he doesn't, or he spends a lot of time and energy projecting this idea that he's going to be this great peacemaker, and to a degree he is in some areas successful for a while, but it's very clear the country really quite likes the idea of war, and really really doesn't like interventions with. Well, they quite like some interventions with Spain, actually. You know, there's a lot of harking back to that. Yeah, I also just wanted to jump in, because we mentioned that he's collaborating with Beaumont as well. And for the modern mind, they're basically a compound name, aren't they? They're sort of, it's Beaumont and Fletcher, which is sort of accurate, but is also inaccurate as well, because he collaborates with a lot of people, doesn't he?
Yes, exactly. Well, actually, Beaumont and Fletcher write together only 8 plays, while the entire corpus of Fletcher is around 50 plays. But Beaumont and Fletcher do collaborate early in Fletcher's career, and especially with the play Philaster, which is one of their great successes, they basically initiate the fashion for what becomes the most significant dramatic genre of the century, namely romantic tragic comedy. So they are very successful, and I mean the name, the idea of Beaumont and Fletcher stuck. So even other great successes of the duo were A King and No King and A Maid's Tragedy, but their partnership interrupts in 1612, and Fletcher continues writing until 1625. I mean, Beaumont gets married, then he gets seriously ill. He dies in 1616. Fletcher remains, let's say, alone without his collaborator and friend. And so for a short period of time, around 12, 18 months between 1612 and 1613, he collaborates with William Shakespeare on three plays, The Lost Cardenio, All Is True or Henry VIII, and The Two Noble Kinsmen. But then Shakespeare retires, and he dies also in 1616, the same year in which Beaumont dies. After Shakespeare's retirement, Fletcher becomes the leading dramatist for the King's Men, and he no longer writes for any other companies. He continues to write solo plays, but he seems to need a collaborator. He seems to have favored collaboration, and he finds a new partner in Philip Massinger. And actually, the number of plays that Fletcher wrote with Massinger, and sometimes also with the assistance of a third playwright, Nathan Field, a boy actor turned playwright. I mean, they write together 18 plays, which is more than double the amount than the plays that Fletcher wrote with Beaumont. But for some reason, the contribution of Massinger to the plays, like, for example, in the Beaumont and Fletcher First Folio, is completely unacknowledged. And there's interesting recent work on the reasons why Massinger's contribution to the First Folio may have been purposely ignored by Owen Price, who has written a very interesting piece on that. And actually, the collaborations with Massinger are very interesting and offer some of the best work in which Fletcher had a hand, but they are not as celebrated as those as the plays that Fletcher wrote with Beaumont. Fletcher died in London in August 1625, according to John Aubrey. A knight of Norfolk invited him to the country because there was the plague in London. But Fletcher decided to remain some more time in London to make himself a suit of clothes. But while the tailor was making it, he fell sick of the plague and died. And so he was buried, as we were saying before, on the 29th of August in what is now Southwark Cathedral. Yes.
We always have to take Aubrey with a little pinch of salt, yes. But I mean, he's got the context right, at least. Yes. You know, it wasn't a great year.
Yes, but he says that it was the tailor himself who told him, who was at the time a very old man. Yes. Who knows?
I'm sure that's definitely true. considering that we're producing audio versions of the merry conceited jests of George Peel, stories about playwrights after their death are often, shall we say, exaggerated. well, I think this is a good juncture to move on to the sort of the thrust of your book on Fletcher's Rome, questioning the classics, looking at some of Fletcher's Roman plays, but you're focusing in on four plays that he collaborates on. So could you tell us a little bit about those plays and the thrust of your book, as it were?
I mean, at first blush, Fletcher does not really look like a classically minded playwright, because he sets few of his plays in the classical world. And those he sets in ancient Greece, for example, they do not rely on an accurate, detailed setting. I mean, it's Greece, but it's actually London. Mm. Things are different in the case of the plays that he sets in Rome, or plays that we can describe as Roman plays. These are four plays which had never been studied together as a group. They are Valentinian, Bonduca, which Fletcher wrote by himself, and then we have The False One and The Prophetess, which Fletcher wrote with Massinger. So the Roman play is a development in Fletcher's career that comes after the termination of his partnership with Beaumont, like many others. I mean, Fletcher's dramaturgy continues to evolve after the termination of his partnership with Beaumont, but for some reason, the idea of Beaumont and Fletcher stuck, you know, and obscured all the rest of Fletcher's production in a way. The idea behind trying to analyze these four plays as a group was to have a comparative critical scrutiny of the play, to shed light both on the single plays and on the plays as a group, to find links with the other plays in the large canon of Fletcher, and especially to give a more accurate assessment of Fletcher's intellectual life and his use of the classics. Because something that I realized early on was that Fletcher seems to display, broadly speaking, a sense of detachment, of suspicion, of skepticism as to everything that has to do with classical models, as though classical models, classical patterns are no longer viable models for the Jacobean era. And this can be seen already in his choice of texts on which to base his Roman plays, because Fletcher's favorite sources in general are vernacular texts in Spanish, in French, in English, and he tends to use translations even though he clearly didn't need them because he knew a great deal of Latin after that terrible grammar school that he attended, I mean. And Fletcher seems to have been steering clear on purpose of a more pronounced classicist bent, and one of the characteristics is that he seems to have avoided the use of those texts that represented the golden age of classical literature and history, those texts that were typically taught in grammar school. And having a close look at these plays, I identified a way of working that Fletcher had with classics, a modus operandi. He tended to choose texts written in the period that we now describe as late antiquity, mostly from Greek historians, so authors describing Rome from a certain distance, so to speak. As I said, he uses non-grammar school texts. He tends to use translations, and he mixes new and old, the vernacular and the classics, and he tends to give more importance to vernacular material.
Just for the listener, sort of the contrast between Fletcher's approach in the early Jacobean sort of 1610s, early 1620s. With some of the plays that have gone before, you've got a lot of neoclassical dramas that are leaning very heavily into the sort of very stoical view of enduring terrible hardships and look how noble we are, and following sources that are much more stolid, shall we say. And it's quite a contrast with what Fletcher does with. And it is an interesting question whether this is how much of this is leaning into the political world of the Jacobean world. I mean, let's not pretend that the Elizabethan world before it was a paragon of virtue, but the presentment of these ideals seem to be much more in the zeitgeist then, whereas here perhaps he's leaning into something a bit different, and we have obviously covered many of these kinds of classical texts before, so you can listen to versions of, you know, the Tragedy of Antony or Cornelia or Caesar's Revenge, which is only slightly earlier than what Fletcher's writing about, but it's a very interesting text, and there's some other Roman plays by some guy. I think some people have heard of him, but they are quite different in terms of their approach. Do continue on that.
Well, yes. For example, we can just mention a few. You mentioned Caesar's Revenge, which is based on Appian. Johnson himself based Sejanus on Tacitus. Fletcher does make some use of Plutarch, for example, the false one, but Fletcher really is different in this because he likes historians of late antiquity, for example, Herodian and Procopius and the Historia Augusta. And I think there are different reasons for that. Of course, it's always difficult to generalize about such a very long period as what we now call late antiquity. But in general terms, the texts of late antiquity exhibit a more fractured narration, a convoluted syntax, strong taste for gossipy anecdotes, And all these qualities are suited to Fletcher's way of handling drama, of handling the theater, because for Fletcher, the periphery is often as important, if not more important, than the center. Single scenes are sometimes more intense than an entire act. And there are moments of lasting impressions in the play that are more important than any idea of consistency. This is, I think, the dramatic side of things. But there's also, as you suggest, a political reason. And in general, these texts of late antiquity have a more pessimistic, a bleaker view of the empire and of life in general. And this clearly transfers to Fletcher's depiction of ancient Rome. Fletcher tends to stay on the imperial period, on the period of empire. I mean, chronologically, technically, the false one is still set in the Republic, because Julius Caesar is technically, Julius Caesar is not the first Roman emperor, but he is treated as an emperor in substance, though not in form. Yes, there's absolutely a political dimension to that.
Yes, in terms of the stories he is choosing, false one is chronologically quite early, but the stories they're telling are these later imperial stories. You know, we are out of what our listeners might call the I Claudius universe of those those initial emperors that we all know quite well. It all gets very messy after that, and people can't necessarily remember which emperor is which or what they're doing. And even the story of the false one is a story that doesn't get dramatized very often. It's Julius Caesar's initial encounter with Cleopatra, and yes, it does sort of turn up in some modern films, but it's not a story that necessarily gets properly treated in its own right. So there's sort of unusual stories, or at least perhaps to our mind, in terms of what he's zooming in on to actually choose as subjects for plays. I mean, it might just be that Julius Caesar, you know, assassination, etc., it's been done by a lot of people, and those sort of areas of the story have been done elsewhere, and that maybe he just wants room to bustle in and find something to do.
Yes. Certainly, when he chooses that segment of the story of Caesar, Fletcher wants. Fletcher introduces False One with a prologue in which he basically says, well, this is, think of this as a sort of prequel to Julius Caesar and Antony and Cleopatra by that other guy. But he also clearly wants to do something different. And this is clear both in his characterization of Caesar and especially in his characterization of Cleopatra. There is no tragic death for Cleopatra in The False One, but there's actually a very brilliant scene in which Cleopatra springs out of a rolled mattress, you know, and so he wants to oppose this dazzling birth of Cleopatra, so to speak, in front of Caesar to the majoritarian theatrical tradition that wants us to see a tragic Cleopatra close to death. As for the other Roman plays, they are set, yes, in a different imperial era to that, different from that to which dramatists were probably used to. He dramatizes emperors such as Valentinian. In The Prophetess, we have Diocletian. And Bonduca is set in the reign of Nero, even though Nero is never actually on stage and is, if I remember correctly, never even mentioned. You know, the fact that the play is set under Nero is chilling in itself. The choice, I think, of this imperial setting is also linked to the fact that Fletcher wants to depict, to portray a corrupted Rome, a corrupted political reality, a decay of politics, which is literalized, for example, in The Prophetess, in which we have the body of the emperor that is decomposing, and it stinks, and people get away from it because it's stinking. And clearly the body of the ruler is a metaphor for the state itself, so this becomes a metaphor for the empire. And also in Valentinian, we are shown a prolonged agony of the emperor on stage because they poison him. And Valentinian in general offers a very claustrophobic and disturbing portrayal of ancient Rome, because this emperor is essentially who rapes the wife of a senator, Lucina, and his lack of self-control is clearly a correlative of the corruption of the state. And history is presented as a series, essentially as a series of bad emperors, one after the other, you know, because when Valentinian dies, the senator, Maximus, becomes emperor, but he's even worse than Valentinian, so they kill him too. And at the end, Rome is left without an emperor, so they need to choose a new one. So that this idea that Rome is badly in need of adequate political leaders, as none of these emperors and leaders that are depicted across these Roman plays is a real model. The interesting thing, I think, of these plays is that they show a generalized detachment of and from the gods. The gods no longer seem to be interested in human events. You know, humankind is left alone on Earth, which is very pessimistic, terrifying. And it is, I think, doubly interesting because Fletcher was the son of a bishop. You know, he has studied at such a religiously oriented institution. I mean, they prayed at 5 a.m. before praying in the cathedral, before praying again in school at 6 a.m. So I think it is really interesting that he presents a strong distance between humankind and the divine.
That's interesting in contrast to William Alexander's take on Julius Caesar, where literally Juno turns up at the meeting and says,
yes,
I killed Caesar. it's all down to me. It's because someone offended me thousands of years ago. And that is why Caesar must die. And it's the sort of domino effect of godly interference somehow leads to this assassination. That is a very deep cut that most people won't get. I think we need to drift into the false one in more detail. I hate to leave, you know, Bonduca and Valentinian and the prophetess,
yes.
But we should talk about the false one. You've done a wonderful new edition. For clarity, I should state that I have been sent a copy. So I suppose that constitutes a bribe. So my opinion is technically invalid, but it's a very good edition, which I enjoyed. Going through enormously. So it is focusing on a young Cleopatra, a relatively younger Julius Caesar. You know, he is in his situation where he's effectively got caught in local politics as part of the wider civil war. It features this very important episode where the Egyptians kill Pompey and chop his head off, which is something that we do have figured in other plays. But it's usually something reported off stage, and it is, okay, you don't see the beheading, but you do see a head, which we may discuss in a moment. So we have these portrayals of Caesar, of Cleopatra, of other... It's a complicated political event. It has been simplified to a degree within the Egyptian politics was quite complicated and interrelated because it's a family at war, but it manages to get into this. It's a siege situation eventually, where Caesar has got sort of trapped in this internecine war between family members and needs to get out the other side. And so it's a really interesting episode. It's a very complicated episode in many ways. And Fletcher and Massinger throw the aforementioned severed head, but also there's a mask. There's the appearance of Cleopatra from it's variously being performed as Cleopatra being unrolled in a carpet in film depictions, but Cleopatra is definitely smuggled in to be presented to Caesar in some fashion, and the play does deal with that. So it's doing an awful lot with all of these different narrative elements and shaping them in different ways. So yes, tell me a little bit about the false one from your perspective, having produced a scholarly edition.
I think that what I've come to believe is that the idea of the play, but this is my opinion, of course, my feeling, came from the idea of Cleopatra coming out of the royal carpet or mattress or whatever, and that then the play was structured around that, because that really is a very important point in the play. It is roughly, I mean, it is in Act 2, Scene 3, so a little bit before the middle of the play, and that changes everything. Because Caesar has followed Pompey to Egypt, and he is not imagining that they will kill him, you know. And after they bring him Pompey's head, one would think that everything's over. But Cleopatra pops up, so to speak, and everything changes again, because Caesar loses himself in pleasures, loses himself in his love for Cleopatra. And so the soldiers are discontented. He loses power, and then he is besieged in the palace of Alexandria, and he can't really accept that. He says, "Caesar besieged! Oh my God!" You know. And so he decides to set everything on fire in order to escape. And one thing that I think is very interesting in this play also is the use of props. Because the head of Pompey and the packet in which Cleopatra is smuggled into the presence of Caesar are really interesting. As we said earlier, chronologically, the false one deals with the final stage of the Republic, but we said it treats Caesar as an emperor in substance. And the first two acts deal at length with the decapitation of Pompey the Great, because Pompey represents in the play the ancient values of the Roman Republic, even though Pompey does never appear on stage. So he's a spirit, he's a presence, you know, the presence of the Republic. And when Septimius, who is a Roman, a Roman who has passed to the Egyptian side, when Septimius brings Pompey's head on stage, this clearly symbolizes the death of the Republic and the birth of the Empire. The head of Pompey is clearly as the correlative of the Republic. And this idea becomes even bleaker, even darker, because the head of Pompey is grotesquely seized in turn by Septimius, Achilles, and Pothinus, because they all want the head to show the head to Caesar, you know? And the severed head of Pompey being carelessly tossed around in the Egyptian court symbolizes the end of the Republic.
Yes, and Caesar has this great reaction to seeing the head. I mean, it's one of those questions of how genuine is Caesar's reactions to things. We have this with various Caesars in other plays, but I the text I think says "ha."
Yes, Caesar says ha a lot. It says ha, but the idea is that his grief and his indignation at the sight of Pompey's head seems to be sincere and a false one. And this is in line with the fact that Caesar has a monologue right before Cleopatra arrives, in which he laments the destruction that he has perpetrated during the conflict against Pompey. And there is one character, Sceva, he's one of the centurions of Caesar, who kind of skeptical regarded the sincerity of Caesar's tears. I mean, but the other characters who are there, including Antony and Dolabella, I mean, they don't hesitate. They show no hesitation in taking Caesar's reaction to be true, to be sincere, and the claims of the Egyptians that Caesar is actually pleased are too partial to be considered. So overall, the play seems to give the impression that Caesar is actually sad at the sight of Pompey's head, and this the treatment is very different from the main source of the play, which is Lucan. Lucan's Pharsalia. In Lucan's Pharsalia, Caesar is a terrible person, and he is really regret-free, and Lucan clarifies that Caesar is faking his tears, but the false one really gives a very different feeling to the scene.
Mm, yes, because it's one thing to want your enemy vanquished. It's another thing to have a beach volleyball with his head. They are quite different things. And he does generally express regret for what's happened in the Civil War. You know, the number of lives lost. Did it have to be this way? Yes. Kind of thoughts. We also have, obviously, we have the figure of Cleopatra, and I think this also intersects with one of the chapters in your book on Fletcher's Rome, as you know, the nature of Roman women, the ideals that are presented, and Cleopatra as this a different force. We're used to Octavia as being presented as this as a figure of a certain kind of virtue, and the way Cleopatra is depicted in this play is slightly different to some other texts as well, and so how do we see about the figure of Cleopatra
in this Roman plays? Fletcher has a number of Roman women, but most of them are secondary roles, minor roles. Then we have two supporting characters and one woman who can be said to be a protagonist, Lucina, but dies halfway through the play. And in general, the Roman women depicted by Fletcher are kind of passive, you know. They embody a passivity that seems to arouse Fletcher's skepticism. And it is interesting that in all these plays, we have three non-Roman women, Boudica, Delphia in The Prophetess, and Cleopatra, who clearly are much more interesting, you know. At the beginning, Cleopatra is the temptation that lures Caesar away from political concerns. But then she realizes that Caesar has lost his masculine self-governance, you know, so to speak. And so she becomes a powerful catalyst for Caesar's regeneration. She infuses new strength, new valor, new courage in Caesar. And so she becomes a powerful, a relevant force in the play. So these non-Roman women, and Cleopatra is an example, and Fletcher, they wield power. They display superior dynamism, initiative, assertiveness. Cleopatra is not scared at the prospect of death when Plotinus threatens her directly, but she manages to infuse courage in the women around her. And these non-Roman women, including Cleopatra, they are clearly more vital, more complex than the Roman women, because the Roman women never really managed to establish these kinds of separate identities of their own. You know, they are limited. Their roles are very limited to wives, widows, or prostitutes, especially in Valentinian. You know, so this Cleopatra is a very interesting take on a character that had been depicted on stage several times before Fletcher and Massinger wrote The False One.
It reflects the sort of the classical reality to a degree, that the nature of the way Roman women were supposed to function in society. You know, that they didn't even actually have their own names. Their names were always adjuncts to their fathers or brothers' names. It was always a feminized version of a male name. So it's sort of there is a certain interesting logic in terms of depicting that society that might be there. So yeah, I mentioned earlier we've talked about the question of the head, the depiction of the head. You know, we have a history of heads in bags in our Zoom sessions. It is a question of how realistic that head is supposed to be, and what the original production or a modern production might do with that. We have that logistical question of how do you bring Cleopatra on? What is she in? What is a packet in a practical sense? But also, I'd say that there is a mask, and Fletcher does seem to it seems to be very much of the time of popping these spectacles into the middle of a play. What does the mask structurally do? What is it there for within the play?
Well, the mask is intended by Ptolemy, the king of Egypt, to bring Caesar again to his side against Cleopatra, because beginning of the play, Ptolemy has confined, basically has put Cleopatra under arrest. The play doesn't mention the fact that technically Ptolemy and Cleopatra were married in Egypt, but so they're brothers, and but they were supposed also to be husband and wife, but Fletcher and Massinger do not use that kind of historical information. And so the smart plan of Ptolemy is to use the mask to show Caesar the wealth of Egypt. So all the gold and all the things that Egypt, all the riches that Egypt has, thanks to the contribution of the River Nile. But the plan seems to backfire, because when Caesar sees all the wealth, all the gold, yes, he is distracted from Cleopatra, but now he wants to seize all the Egyptian wealth. And he, in the middle of mask, and the mask is interrupted by his exclamation. I mean, why did I fight civil wars when I could have come here and taken all this wealth, you know? And the mask would have been particularly suited to an indoor playhouse like the Blackfriars, because all the props that they might have used to simulate the gold and glittering stuff, the effect would have been probably increased, heightened by the light of candles. So it would have been a very credible distraction from Cleopatra's beauty.
And it's also, in a sense, it's the kind of spectacle that works better in a confined space, in the sense that if you're doing that on an open stage, you know, some stuff coming on stage, you know, it isn't actually very impressive. Whereas if you actually can bring a lot of shiny objects onto a relatively small stage that is already crowded with other bodies, it has an impact that works very effectively. Yeah. I say it's one of those sort of problems of spectacle on a large stage is you need a lot of spectacle to make it land a spectacle, and for that to function. And the same, I think, to do agree with the heads as well. I mean, there's quite a few. There are a reasonable number of bodies. It's not a terribly bloodthirsty play, but it does, for the moments of death and bodies being displayed, they again need impact. And I think a smaller space gives that punch in a way that I'm not sure a large open space would. And though, of course, the repertoire may split between spaces anyway, depending on seasons. So it's never an absolute. But yeah, it feels internal rather than external.
Yes, there are several heads, because there's the head of Pompey, and then at the end of the play, there are the three heads of the three Egyptians, you know, Achilles, Septimius, and Pothinus. And together with them, there's the body of Ptolemy lying on the ground.
Yes. Spoilers for anyone who don't know who was this particular leg of the Egyptian family politics. Cleopatra comes out okay. Let's just say that. And so we have this conclusion of the narrative of, you know, who killed Pompey and the repercussions thereof. And there is a journey of regret about that action throughout the play as well. By the chief pusher of that, of just going, you know, that actually it was a terrible thing to do. It was a terrible betrayal. And there is the wider political, but there are all the personal interactions that are really, really nicely done in the play, I think.
Yes, because Septimius think that once he kills, he decapitates Pompey, people will love him, but they are actually disgusted by what he has done, and so he tries to repent. And this is also signaled by his change of clothes. He is all wearing black, you know, but then he is tempted again to viciousness by Pothinus, with the promise that killing Caesar would be an even greater enterprise, and that at that point people will love him, and he will be able to do anything he wants. But again, he repents and tries to warn Caesar, but nobody believes him, you know.
Yeah, I mean again, it's often the secondary characters that you have enough room for maneuver in terms of history. You know, you can't rewrite too much of Caesar. You can't rewrite too much of Cleopatra. You can nudge the edges of history. But when you've got effectively minor players, you can really play around with them and work with them, you know, and also with fictional characters within a narrative, you know.
Yes, and probably Septimius gives the title to the play. He is probably the false one.
Yes, because that is the question, title. Isn't it? Why is it called the false one? Who is being false?
Yes. I mean, several characters are being false to themselves or to somebody else, but probably the falsest one is Septimius.
Right, we are running out of time, alas, even though I'm sure we could actually talk about this play a lot more. We will get around to reading it and all of these plays as part of our exploring sessions, and we'll be working towards full cast audio adaptations and full productions of them. The nice thing about history plays is that you can present them in seasons and you have chronology, or for that matter, plays that are all about exactly the same subject but in slightly different angles. So there are a whole host of ways of presenting these that actually have just about enough commercial leg to them to make them viable propositions. So hopefully we'll be able to return in the future with more of this in a more active, more performy way. But till then, we obviously have things in book form. Where can we find copies of your books, in the real world or online?
Well, both books are available on the Manchester University Press website. And if you subscribe to the Manchester University Press newsletter, you can have 30% off all books. So I think that is the best place to get a book.
Yes, so that's John Fletcher's Rome, Questioning the Classics. That's covering all of the plays pretty much we've discussed here, and also a critical edition of The False One by John Fletcher and Philip Messenger, and they're all available from Manchester University Press. Hopefully there will be some links in the show description. Otherwise, there are these things called search engines you could sort of type away at. And the internet's remarkably good at these things for finding them. Any final thoughts you want to throw in before I close the session?
I hope that all the work that I and other colleagues, the work that we have been doing on Fletcher will help to bring Fletcher to a wider audience, both of readers and hopefully of spectators in the theater. I've just finished another edition of another play in which Fletcher had a hand. It's Thierry and Fiodoré. It dramatizes French history. Fletcher collaborates with Messenger and Field. It is a very, very entertaining play. And I hope that all the work that we are doing will help more people appreciate John Fletcher and his works.
Ah, well, with that note, all that remains is to thank my wonderful guest for joining me today. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.